Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Welcome to Hard Currency, the podcast from the Financial Times on the $5 trillion foreign exchange market and other parts of the market. I'm Roger Blitz, and this week we've seen three big market moves, a pretty strong recovery in the dollar, the much-watched US Treasury 10-year yield hitting 3% for the first time in 4 years, and oil at $75 a barrel. Now, are these big market shifts here to stay, or are they a mere hiccup and a pause? Our guest this week is Bill McQuaker, multi-asset portfolio manager at Fidelity International. Bill, which of those three really interests you?
I think for me, the most significant of those three developments is the move to 3% on the 10-year Treasury. It's something that has been brewing for a while. Mm-hmm. And investors, I think there's certainly a group of investors who see this as a clear signal that the 35-year bull market in fixed income is finally behind us.
You say it's been brewing quite a while. It's been brewing a long time. And is it just a number? In other words, is it something psychological, a round number? Or is there anything particularly significant about 3%?
I think the reality is it's just a number.
Yeah.
But one should look at it in a broader context. Long-term interest rates in the US have moved up. Short-term interest rates, if you look at two-year government bonds, yields there are back where they were prior to the global financial crisis. So the whole interest rate curve has repriced in the US, and this is something I like.
I mean, the problem I have is the reason why I asked that question: is it just a number? Is it actually a number that helps fit the narrative of what you described, how that group of investors see it? You know, the end of that bond bull market. I mean, is it fitting a narrative rather than actually something that is actually really happening?
I think it's reflecting things that have really happened in the world. So in terms of what's gotten us here, there's been quite an unwinding of the global policy stance. Quantitative easing ended and actually reversed in the US, about to end in Europe.
Yes. I'll come back to that question on.
Indeed. Short-term interest rates having already gone up a fair way in the US. In terms of global growth, the global growth story has been very good the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And perhaps most importantly, in terms of this most recent move, the oil price, as you mentioned in your introduction, has moved up quite meaningfully. And that's beginning to feed into people's expectations for inflation, at least in the short run. So it's not just a number. There's a narrative behind it that I think goes some way to justifying it.
Okay, having put you on the spot once, Bill, I've got to put you on the spot again, because this is a question about the oil price. I mean, this is, again, significant in the short-term perspective, but the long-term, say 5 to 10 years, the story of oil is structurally weak, is it not? And that therefore, is this just, the oil bulls perhaps having their last hurrah?
That may well be the case, but there are times in markets where what's going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years is important, and there are times when what's going to happen over the next quarter or two is important. And I think at the moment we should be focusing on the short run, although how the short run plays into the medium term could turn out to be tremendously important. So if we look at what's caused the oil price to rally, the oil price has rallied because OPEC's got a grip on output. Shale, that was supposed to be able to deliver unending quantities of oil at the touch of a button, hasn't been quite as flexible as people expected. Countries like Venezuela have seen production fall and continuing to fall. And the reality is that the global oil market is quite tight.
Yes.
Looking to the future, I think a very important question for markets is, will we see another meaningful ratcheting up in the oil price in the short run that could destabilise medium-term inflation expectations?
Right, because I want to ask you about what all this means. But you could argue that, you know, since the January euphoria in equities, we've had a little bit of a slowdown. If as you say, these two important moments, the 3% moment at yield, oil at 75%, are going to be market drivers, then great. I mean, this is what the market has been waiting for the last few weeks, isn't it? All this is quite good. Is it quite good or is it quite worrying because oil throws up all sorts of inflation concerns?
I think these developments on balance are more worrying than they are encouraging.
Oh dear.
For the, they put downward pressure on asset prices. A higher discount rate is not particularly helpful, and you're perhaps seeing that feeding through into the valuation of the FANGs, the high growth stocks that have been so important for equities. And a higher oil price is a bit of an impediment to economic growth. You know, why was the recovery so strong in 16 and 17? Mm. One of the reasons is the oil price went very low.
Yes.
Now, from the bottom, we're up 140, 150%. That's quite a big rise in the oil price, and that takes some demand out of the global economy. So I look to the next quarter or two, and I see quite a variety of cross currents that are likely to maintain financial market volatility at these elevated levels.
You see, I thought we actually wanted some inflation, and I thought that we wanted inflation because we wanted central banks to start raising rates. We wanted them to get back into a position whereby they could start cutting rates when, you know, rather than being in this zero bound area. And actually, we should be helping to push forward. Whereas what's been happening is that just the slight softening in some of the data is causing some of this policy normalization that you talked about earlier on to actually start being pushed back and back and back. The result being that rather than talking about policy convergence, we're now looking at a policy divergent world.
Well, I think you're slightly ahead of the game in saying that policy normalisation is already being pushed back and back and back. But can I see the door opening to that possibility because of these developments? Could be. But I would contend that we're not there yet. So what happens over the next quarter or two is going to be quite important. The way that I would contextualize it, the framework that I think is important here, is that we have some big structural forces that for the last 10 years and more have made it very difficult for interest rates to pick up at all. And I'm thinking here about the quantity of debt in the world, the demographics of the world, where there's a savings glut and there's a shortage of projects for that money to be invested in. So the cost of capital was kind of pinned to the ground. And we had today capital goods data out of the United States, and the tax cut was supposed to cause a bit of a boom in capital spending, flat as a pancake. So those structural forces, I think, are in place, but they've been challenged by the cyclical momentum in the data. So it's a clash of forces.
Yes.
And the question is, who's going to win?
Well, and what we haven't mentioned, listeners might be surprised we haven't mentioned it yet, is the European Central Bank meeting and what Mario Draghi said.
Yes.
I mean, you know, one of the great classic sitting on the fence statements from Draghi today. So to your very point, really, you know, that investors need to just a little bit more data to understand what's really happening.
Investors and central banks. And I think my interpretation of what Draghi said today is it was an exercise in holding the line.
Yes.
The ECB's laid out a path to normalisation. They acknowledged there's some deterioration in the data in the near term, but they were keener to emphasise why that was likely to be temporary, why it wasn't that significant, because it's a bit early to abandon the normalisation narrative that they laid out. One or two more issues in both directions could see that change.
The dollar rising, do you see that as a turning point, significant?
I think at this stage it's more of a market driven event than it is driven by fundamentals at work in the world.
Right.
Investors are pretty short the dollar, and the narratives that have seen the dollar sell off I think are now very well established in yes. the market psyche. And so anything that comes along that maybe suggests a reason for a bit of dollar strength, like the slowdown in Europe, has allowed it to move in that direction. Yes. And 3% on the US 10-year bonds has put a bit of pressure on emerging market currencies. Yes. And that's been consistent with dollar strength. For that to really gain ground, I think the slowdown narrative has to get a bit more traction, because there is scope, there definitely is room for a completely new story about the dollar to gain prominence. And that would be the US is still growing when other countries are slowing, mm-hmm. thanks to the tax cut. And the US has got a very considerable interest rate differential versus the likes of Europe and the UK and Japan, yes. that investors have willfully ignored through the global economic upswing. But if things are slowing down, maybe that becomes important again.
But you would say that the foreign exchange market at the moment is a bystander in the broader market? Or
I see more interesting things elsewhere as captured by yes. this discussion. But FX is never it doesn't stay in the corner for too long.
Bill, just finally, you're just back from China.
I am.
Tell us about what were your big takeaways from there?
Well, I went expecting to be focused on the slowdown in China, and I came back thinking hard about the trade dispute between China and the US. The trade story is more complicated than I thought, and more troubling than I thought, quite frankly.
Right.
The perspective that I came away with is that the US sees this in one or two ways. One possibility is that they are tired of an uneven playing field that is too beneficial to China. So things like forced technology yes. transfer, forced joint ventures to enter the Chinese market, the US wants to see those done away with, so it's a more level playing field. If that's the case, then that's not a particularly welcome development for Chinese companies and for China, because it'll likely slow their pace of development.
Yes.
And while I was there, a company called ZTE was sanctioned. The US announced that they might not sell it some sure. chips. And the reaction amongst the Chinese that I met was quite interesting. There was a sense that this was unfair, that inappropriate behaviour, that China should ensure that it invests aggressively so that it can't be held to ransom in this way. And there is some history of the Chinese population reacting badly to developments outside China. I remember recently the South Koreans announced that they were going to install some anti-ballistic missile systems, and Chinese people stopped buying South Korean cosmetics. If Chinese people stop buying iPhones, then I think that's the mechanism, that's the type of mechanism that sees these trade disputes escalate.
Well, next week we will. I mean, Donald Trump is sending Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, to China to
yes,
try and smooth these things out. We will see how they develop. My thanks to Bill McQuaker of Fidelity. Also next week, the Fed meeting, unquestionably the key market event to follow. Join us again to discuss what we learn from Jay Pound's latest views on the US economy and indeed the global economy. Until then, from Hard Currency, it's goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.